continue to study Ecclesiastes here on Wednesday night. And I want you to look in chapter 5, down in verse number 8. And we'll go tonight from verse number 8 down to verse 20. Ecclesiastes chapter 5. And follow along as I started reading in verse 8. If thou seest the oppression of the poor and violent perverting of judgment and justice in a province, marvel not at the matter, for he that is higher than the highest regardeth, and there be higher than they. Moreover, the profit of the earth is for all. The king himself is served by the field. And he that loveth silver shall not be satisfied with silver, nor he that loveth abundance with increase. This is also vanity. And when goods increase, they are increased that eat them. And what good is there to the owners thereof, saving the beholding of them with their eyes? The sleeping of a laboring man is sweet, whether he eat little or much, but the abundance of the rich will not suffer him to sleep. There is a sore evil which I have seen under the sun, namely riches kept for the owners thereof to their hurt. But those riches perish by evil travail, and he begetteth a son, and there is nothing in his hand. And as he came forth of his mother's womb naked, shall he return to go as he came, and shall take nothing of his labor which he may carry away in his hand. And this also is a sore evil, that in all points as he came, so shall he go. And what profit hath he then that hath labored for the wind? All his days also he eateth in darkness, and he hath much sorrow and wrath with his sickness. Behold, that which I have seen, it is good and comely for one to eat and to drink and to enjoy the good of all his labor that he taketh under the sun all the days of his life, which God giveth him, for it is his portion. Every man also to whom God hath given riches and wealth and hath given him power to eat thereof and to take his portion and to rejoice in his labor, this is the gift of God. For he shall not much remember the days of his life, because God answereth him in the joy of his heart. Now the title of my sermon tonight is Greedy or Grateful. One or the other. Now, the preacher, Solomon, we've identified Solomon as the writer of this letter, this journal, and he calls himself Koheleth, which means the preacher. And so the preacher now begins to speak to his congregation about a very sensitive subject. It is the subject of money and wealth. Someone has said that the most sensitive hand or the most sensitive nerve in the human body is the one that goes from the hand to the pocketbook. Most people are uncomfortable hearing a sermon about money, and many preachers are uncomfortable preaching about the subject of money, and partly because when a preacher preaches about money, sometimes he worries that the congregation will misjudge his motives. And people sometimes think that when you speak about money, it's really a secular subject, not a spiritual subject. But what we see here in chapter 5 is, in the first part of chapter 5, Solomon warns about the wrong attitude towards worship. And now here in the last part of chapter 5, Solomon warns about the wrong attitude towards wealth. And by putting these two together, by way of implication, he is letting us know that the subject of wealth is also a spiritual subject, just like the subject of worship. Did you know that part of our worship is included in the way that we feel about money? Our attitude towards material things is all part of our worship. And God knows that the consecration that doesn't reach the pocketbook doesn't reach the heart. I heard about a pastor who wanted to baptize a convert, and the convert did not want to be baptized in his robe. He wanted to be baptized in his clothes. And so the day came to baptize his convert, and he said, "Wait a minute, pastor, let me take my wallet out of my pocket." And the pastor said, "No, leave it in. I want to baptize your wallet as well as you." And there are a lot of Christians who need to have their wallet baptized. And there's a sense in which Solomon is telling us to do that. The Bible has a lot to say about money. For example, of the 38 parables in the New Testament, 16 have to do with our relationship to material things. There are 500 verses on faith. There are 500 verses on prayer. But there are 2,000 verses on stewardship and our relationship to wealth. One verse in every six in the first three Gospels relates to money. Now, also keep in mind that Solomon, if anyone has the right and the credibility to talk about wealth and money, it is Solomon. He has the credentials for it. You remember when the Queen of Sheba came to visit Solomon to see all his wealth, the Bible says when she saw it all, there was no more spirit in her. We would say it, she was blown away at all of his wealth. And she said, the half has not been told. So when Solomon speaks about money and wealth and material things, he speaks from experience. No one understands the blessings and cursings of wealth like Solomon. And no one understands the pitfalls and the dangers to avoid better than Solomon. Now, let me talk to you a little bit about the structure of this passage here in chapter 5. What he's really showing us from verses 8 down to verse 20 are two different approaches to wealth. Or we could say this is really two different approaches to life in general. First, we're going to look at the approach of the greedy man, the one who is trying to live a life of getting more. And then we're going to see the approach of the grateful man, or we could even call him the God-centered man. Now, remember, Solomon, much of what he writes in this journal is based on his observations of life. So he is looking out and he is observing. He's observing the greedy approach. And he comes up with a conclusion. Look in verse 13. There is a sore evil which I have seen under the sun, namely riches kept back for the owners thereof to their hurt. The word evil there, halah, which means to become sick, to be deeply grieved over something. It's the idea of thinking about something and it just makes you really, really sick. You ever been that way? Just to think about something, it grieves you so deeply. And then he looks at the second approach and he gives a conclusion in verse 18. He said, behold, that which I have seen, it is good and it is comely. And the word good, tav, means desirable. Comely means beautiful. So in essence, he's saying there are two approaches to this thing of wealth, to this thing of riches, to this thing called life. You can take the greedy approach or the grateful approach. And you have to choose which one you're going to do. It's somewhat similar to the ultimatum that Jesus gave us in the New Testament when he said, you cannot serve God and mammon. You can't serve two masters. Either you will serve God and use money, or you'll serve money and use God. So you better choose. So let's look at the first approach, the greedy approach. And we see this from verses 18 down to verse 17. Solomon speaks first to those who are money mad, to those who feel the answer to all their problems in life is more money. This is the people who set their eyes on riches, who say, get all you can and can all you get. It is the desire just to have more, to get more. It is what Paul warned about in the New Testament when he talked about the love of money. And in essence, what Solomon is going to show us here is that wealth is not all it's cracked up to be. It doesn't do all for you that you think it can. He lists dangers of trying to seek happiness in this life through the acquisition of wealth. And here's the first one. Wealth is the cause for much corruption. Look in verse 8. If thou seest the oppression of the poor and violent perverting of judgment and justice in a province, marvel not at the matter, for he that is higher than the highest regardeth, and there be higher than they. Now, the first danger here is the loss of honesty and integrity. A man might be trying to make money and lose his reputation and become dishonest in that endeavor. And so what Solomon is talking about here in this context is the context of government and public officials. And what he's saying is the reason there is so much corruption and oppression in government is because of the love of money. Money, the love of money will cause public officials to pervert justice, which will result in the oppression of the poor. That's why Solomon says in verse 8, don't be surprised when you see the violent perverting of judgment and justice. And then in verse 8 he says, for he is higher than the highest, or he that is higher than the highest regardeth, and there be higher than he. You say, what does that mean? Well, this verse is somewhat tough to interpret, but what Solomon is describing is public officials looking out for each other. On every level in governmental politics or in governmental structure, they're watching each other and they're keeping an eye on each other to make sure that they get their cut. That's the idea. To make sure that they get the piece of the pie. And what he's saying is, there's higher than the highest, and there's one even higher than that. And the idea is that the corruption goes all the way to the top. They're watching each other to make sure that they get what they want. This is the reason for injustice and oppression, Solomon says, in government. It starts at the highest level. Greedy kings, greedy politicians. And look at verse number 9. Moreover, the profit of the earth is for all. Now, when Solomon talks about the profit of the earth, it is a reference to money gained by taxation. So money gained by taxation is shared by all those in power, is what he's saying. And you can rest assured that the king is going to get his share of that. In fact, when he says the king himself is served by the field, that is, the king profits by taxes on the hardworking man that is working in the field, on the farmer, the laborer, he'll take taxes from him and he'll get his share of what he wants. Now, isn't this principle true? Haven't we seen this time and time again throughout history? The governments overtax and then they abuse the money. We've seen this a lot. And Solomon is talking about this. One man who was overtaxed said, not only is Washington's face on our money, but Washington's hands is on it also. Another man said the IRS must love poor people because it makes so many of them. Now, all men are proud and greedy by nature. And when they get a position of responsibility where they have power, there's always the temptation of using that power to get more for themselves. And there are many men who started out very sincere with strong convictions and morals who gradually began to compromise their integrity to gain more for themselves. It's like the old saying that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. There was a senator by the name of Mark O. Hatfield. He's a former senator, actually. One time he delivered a speech at the Chicago prayer breakfast. And this is what he said. He said, the more prestige and power a man gains, the harder it is for him to admit that he's wrong. He also tends to lose an awareness of his culpability before God. And then he went on to say that whenever power becomes the aim of a man's life, he unconsciously places himself above the laws of God and his fellow man. And then he went on to warn Christian leaders to watch out for these pitfalls. Now, it could be easy for us to here tonight to point our fingers at politicians, but let us remind ourselves that this principle is for us as well. We all have to maintain financial integrity. In fact, as a minister, I must maintain financial integrity. I remember when I candidated to be the pastor of the church at Ellendale, they said, can we look into your background? We want to check all of your financial history and all of your background. And they explained to me that we need to do this now because we've run into so many ministers that have no financial integrity and have taken advantage of so many people. And they said it was necessary. And of course, I told them to go right ahead because as a minister, the Bible makes it very clear in 1 Timothy that I must live a blameless life. And but by the way, that's not just for ministers. That's for you as well. You need to maintain financial integrity. And so Solomon says wealth is the cause for much corruption. But also notice wealth does not satisfy. Look in verse number 10. He that loveth silver shall not be satisfied with silver, nor he that loveth abundance with increase. This also is vanity. Now, Solomon is just stating a very well-known proverb here. And notice he uses the word love. He that loveth silver. Notice he didn't say possess. There's nothing wrong with possessing riches. There's nothing wrong with possessing wealth. That's not what Solomon is against. In fact, if you'll notice in the Bible that many of God's greatest servants were wealthy men because God blessed them. There's nothing wrong with having wealth. Nothing wrong with having riches. What he's talking about is the love of these things. The love of possessions, the love of money, the love of riches. It's not wrong to possess money. It's just wrong when money possesses you. And this warning is to the money hungry. When a person becomes greedy and obsessed with gain, that attitude begins to enslave him. And no matter how much he gets, he's got to have more because he's enslaved. He pursues wealth as his goal. Wealth is his quest in life, and he is a slave to it. And yet there's no satisfaction in it. We've probably heard this a lot. Someone asked the first billionaire in the world, John D. Rockefeller, how much money will it take to satisfy you? And he said, just a little bit more. He wasn't satisfied. Swindoll said this, money can bring tons of comfort, but not an ounce of contentment. Now, the contemporary author, Jesse O'Neill, has diagnosed this spiritual problem. She calls it affluenza. the disease of affluenza. That's the desire to have more things, to be affluent, to possess wealth. And she says in her book, every American has a little bit of affluenza in them. Even when it seems like we're thankful on the surface for all that God gives us, there seems to be underneath this desire or even thoughts about how can I get more? How can I have more? It describes the sudden pain of discontentment we feel when we're told we can't afford to buy something. And then what do? We buy it anyway and just put it on what? A credit card. And then we go into debt. Now, the preacher warns about this dangerous disease, affluenza. And he says that this approach to life is vanity. It's vanity. Let me give you the next thing. Wealth is the cause for much corruption. Wealth does not satisfy. But notice the next one. Wealth makes others want to take it from you. Look in verse 11. Wealth makes others want to take it from you. When goods increase, they are increased that eat them. And what good is there to the owners thereof, saving the beholding of them with their eyes? And what Solomon is saying is, you notice that the more wealth a man has, the more expenditures he seems to accumulate. And when the income increases, the outgo increases. When you have a lot of money, Solomon says there's a lot of people standing in line with their hand out wanting some of that money. And he says it gets to the point where really the only benefit you have is just watching it. Just you get to see it, but you don't even really get to handle it because it comes in one place and it goes out the other. Because there are so many people that want them. Notice where it says they are increased that eat them. That phrase refers to the way people come to consume a man's wealth. He may be referring to the oppressive government that he talked about in verses 8 and 9. It may be a wealthy man's children who can't seem to get enough and he's constantly forking out more for them because they haven't really learned to work on their own. Or perhaps he needs to get them out of trouble. It might be people who come to a wealthy man for donations. Or it might be people who are beggars who come and ask for more. It may be friends. You ever notice that a wealthy man has a lot of friends? Well, that's biblical. Proverbs 14:20. The poor is hated even of his own neighbor, but the rich man has many friends. Proverbs 19:4. Wealth makes many friends, but the poor is separated from his neighbor. A wealthy man always has an entourage of opportunists that are around him wanting to get something from him. And that's what Solomon is saying. When you have a lot of wealth, people want to take it from you. But here's another thing that he points out. Not only is wealth the cause for much corruption, wealth doesn't satisfy, others want to take it from you, but also wealth keeps you up at night. Look in verse 12. The sleep of a laboring man is sweet, whether he eat little or much, but the abundance of the rich will not suffer him to sleep. As a general rule, Solomon says, people who work hard all day, especially if they work with their hands, are always ready for a good night's sleep. And whether they've had a good supper, a decent supper, or whether they've had just a little bit, barely enough, and they go to bed a bit hungry, it doesn't seem to matter. They go right to sleep. That's what he's saying. Take, for example, a man who works in a factory. He goes in at 7, he punches in at 7, he punches out at 3:30. He goes home and he gets his son who came home from school and he takes him out and they play baseball. Perhaps he hits a few flies to him or maybe even has time now to go to his son's Little League game. In fact, he has time to even help coach his son's Little League game. And then after he's done with that, he comes home from the game and he gets a bowl of chili. Takes some Fritos and crunches them up and puts them in the chili. You guys know what I like to do in the evening, right? Crunches, and then he eats a bowl of chili. And then he watches TV, watches the news, and then he crashes around 10 or 10:30. And in 60 seconds, his wife hears him snoring. You know what? There's no anxiety in that kind of a life. The man is working hard. He's meeting the needs of his family. He seems to be very happy and contented. And it's a very simple yet contented life. But on the other hand, the rich, Solomon says in verse 12, but the abundance of the rich will not suffer him to sleep. You know why? Because the rich man is constantly worried about his riches. The person who is pursuing more and more, and he wants more money and he's greedy, he can't sleep because he's stressed out, because he's afraid that someone is going to take his money away from him. And so therefore, Solomon says he can't sleep. Again, I'm quoting from Rockefeller, who's taken a lot of abuse from preachers, but I'm just going to keep on here. He was the first Christian millionaire, as I said, who made millions. And this is what he said. I have made many millions, but they have brought me no happiness. He said, I would barter them all for the days I sat on an office stool in Cleveland and counted myself rich on $300 a week. Vanderbilt said this, the care of $200 million is too great a load for any brain or back to bear. It is enough to kill anyone. There is no pleasure in it. End quote. And then there's John Jacob Astor. He said this, quote, I am the most miserable man on the earth. End quote. Henry Ford, the automobile king, said, work is the only pleasure I have. He said, I was happier when I was doing a mechanic's job. And then Andrew Carnegie said this, millionaires who laugh are rare. My experience is that wealth is apt to take the smiles away. That's exactly what Solomon is saying here. Wealth will keep you up all night. But here's another thing. Wealth is easily lost. Look in verse 13. There is a sore evil which I have seen under the sun, namely riches kept for the owners thereof to their hurt. But those riches perish by evil travail, and he begetteth a son, and there is nothing in his hand. And Solomon again says, this is a grievous evil, which again literally means this makes me sick to think about this. Here's a man, here's a person who has hoarded all of his riches, and yet he loses it in an instance. And he, to prove his point, Solomon just gives us this scenario here in verses 13 and 14. Martin Luther says of this that God permits the very riches in which people trust to bring about the ruin of those who own them. The story that Solomon gives here concerns a wealthy man who all his life has tried to hoard all of his wealth, yet in one risky investment, he loses it all. He lost it all. I remember when I was in seminary, I had a seminary professor who taught me how to invest in the stock market. And he taught me all the ins and the outs and some of the secrets and things to look for and how to invest. And he said, you know, don't invest money that you can't afford to lose. But I remember I started investing some money in some stocks. And you know what? What he taught us to do is to do it short term. It goes up and then you pull it out and you make some money on that. And you just keep doing that. And I started learning how to do that. And I remember one time I invested in a stock and it went up. And after a few weeks, I pulled it out and I doubled my money. And I thought, man, this is great. And then one day I invested in a stock and it went up. And the next afternoon when I looked at it, it was gone. Just like that, it was gone. Over. Like a puff of smoke, it was gone. So I stopped doing that. But you know what? This is what Solomon is talking about here. You can just lose overnight. In fact, there was a man in my church, I remember, a very wealthy man, who told me this story. He said that he invested in the stock market in gold. And he said that was at a time when gold was going crazy. And he said pretty soon it just kept going up and up and up and up. And he said, and I doubled my money, and then I tripled my money, and then I quadrupled my money. And he said, then I had $1 million that I had made in the gold market. He said, you know what I did? He said, I went and I pulled it all out. I said, man, that's great. He said, well, that's not the end of the story. He said, my stockbroker talked to me about putting it back in. And he said, if you just put it back in, the gold is still going up. He said, it will double and you'll have $2 million. And so he did what he knew in his heart he shouldn't do. He put that million back in, hoping that it would double. And guess what? Instead of going up, it crashed. And he couldn't meet the margin. And he lost all of it. And I could still see the depressed look on his face years later when he was telling me this story. He said, you know what? I already had more than I needed. But the desire to have even more was too great. And I did what I know that I shouldn't do. That's what Solomon is describing here in verse number 14. Here's a man who has hoarded, has saved, and then suddenly in verse 14, but those riches perish by evil travail. One risky, bad investment because he still wants more and he loses it all. Now, back in Solomon's day, they didn't have the stock market, but they had ships that they would put their wealth on, perhaps hoping to sell or get a return. and those ships would crash or they would go down in the ocean. Or they would have camel trains that would be robbed and attacked in the wilderness, and a man could lose everything there. But whatever the reason, this man took a gamble and he ended up destitute as a result. And even worse, it says in verse number 14, and he begetteth a son and there is nothing in his hand. That is, there's nothing for him now to leave his son. This story assumes that the Bible teaches in other places that parents should leave a legacy for their children. In planning for the future, we should not only think about ourselves, but also our children. And so here now, this man has nothing to give to his son. Now, Solomon gives us a sixth reason to resist affluenza. Not only does wealth cause much corruption, wealth does not satisfy. Others want to take it from you. It keeps you up all night. It's easily lost. But here's the next thing. Wealth cannot be taken with us when we die. Look at verse 15. He continues the story of this man who lost it all. As he came forth of his mother's womb, naked shall he return to go as he came, and shall take nothing of his labor, which he may carry away in his hand. This is also a sore evil. This, Solomon says, all the labor of his hands now will count for nothing. If all you live for is to get money and make money, then when you die, you're going to lose it all. You're going to have nothing because you leave this world with nothing. That's why, by the way, beloved, it is good for Christians to lay up treasure in heaven, to live for the things of the kingdom, because when you live for the things of the kingdom and you invest yourself in the kingdom, God's kingdom is eternal and the investment is eternal and the dividends are eternal. That's why Jesus said, lay up treasure in heaven. Don't live for the things of this world. Live for the things of the kingdom. Because if all you do is live for the things of this world, when it comes time to die, you're going to lose it all. And like this man, you end up with nothing. Psalm 49, verse 17 says, for when he dieth, he shall carry nothing away. His glory shall not descend after him. In 1 Timothy 6, 7, Paul said, for we brought nothing into this world, and it is certain that we can carry nothing out. Now, in verse 17, then, Solomon summarizes the reasons not to live for money. Notice what he says in verse 16 and 17. This also is a sore evil, that in all points as he came, so shall he go. And what profit hath he that hath labored for the wind? All his days also he eateth in darkness, and he hath much sorrow and wrath with his sickness. Verse 17 gives the pathetic picture of where greed will ultimately take you. Derek Kidner writes, if anything is worse than the addiction money brings, it is the emptiness that it leaves. Here in this story, the miser will end up alone in his misery. Philip Ryken wrote this about this. He said, because he lives in spiritual darkness, his soul will be vexed with many anxieties. The ungodly pursuit of wealth will take its physical toll, leaving him in poor health. He will also be a very angry, old, bitter man who has ever heard of a happy miser. Such is the path of the greedy. Now, however, there's a better way. There's a better way. I'm glad that Solomon doesn't leave us on this negative note, because he's saying there's a much better approach to life. There is an approach to life that will bring joy. So notice the second thing. We saw the greedy approach, but now I want you to see the grateful approach, or we could say the God-centered approach. Look in verse 18. Behold, that which I have seen, it is good and comely for one to eat and to drink and to enjoy the good of all his labor that he taketh under the sun all the days of his life, which God giveth him, for it is his portion. Rather than the greedy approach to life where you try to get all you can and place all your hope for happiness in money, there's another option, Solomon says. He sees a person who has learned to trust God for all things. He's not constantly looking for more. He's not greedy of gain. He's learned to enjoy the things that money cannot buy. By the way, if you want to know how rich you are, add up everything that money cannot buy, everything that you have that money cannot buy and death cannot take away, and that's how rich you truly are. This person sees money as powerless to give him the really best gifts. Money can buy a house, but it can't make a home. Money can pay tuition, but it can't give you an education. Money can hire a doctor, but it can't make you well. And Solomon is telling us, rather than placing your hope in gold, place all of your hope in God. Solomon is encouraging the reader in verse 18 to learn to be content with the simple yet beautiful gifts that God gives us. These are the things that money cannot give, but only God can give. Now, as you read these verses, verse 18, 19, and 20, and we'll touch on each one as we close, what I want you to see is what Solomon really thinks is the source of joy. Now, some scholars read these verses, and they just totally misinterpret these, and they give the impression that he's kind of being sarcastic and kind of stoic. He's kind of saying, you know, just eat and drink and be merry because you're going to die. But that is not what Solomon is doing here. He's giving us a God-centered view of life. Just as Solomon throughout this book has been honest to tell us what is vain and meaningless, now he's honest to tell us where real enjoyment in life comes from. This is another one of those enjoyment passages that we've seen here in the book of Ecclesiastes. Now, what I want you to see is that in the earlier verses that we read, from verses 8 down to verse 17, you never see the mention of God at all. But in verses 18 to 20, he mentions God repeatedly. Wherever enjoyment he finds, it is God-centered. That's what he's trying to tell us. Without God, life is meaningless and miserable, especially if you're living for money. But when we know the God of joy, even money can be a blessing. Now, to really understand this, look at the phrasing in verse 19. Notice what it says. Every man also to whom God hath given riches and wealth. Now, again, earlier, Solomon listed reasons why wealth and money cannot make us happier, give us satisfaction. Yet here, he says, if God has given you wealth and money, he says in verse 18, you should enjoy it. Now, you might sit back and say, well, no, wait a minute, that's a contradiction. First, he says that you'll never find enjoyment and wealth and enjoyment and satisfaction in wealth and money. And yet now in these verses, he's saying, if God gives it to you, you should enjoy it. Is that a contradiction? No. He is pointing to where the power of enjoyment comes from. It comes from God and God alone. Both having things and enjoying things is a gift from Almighty God. And this balanced view, this profound insight should give us really an understanding of how to keep things balanced with regard to earthly things. Let me tell you something. This world in which we live, it has a lot of riches that God has put in it for us to enjoy them. But the enjoyment does not lie in the gifts. The enjoyment lies in the giver of those gifts. That's the point that Solomon is trying to make. That's why it's always useless to pursue things, to pursue possessions. The ability to enjoy wealth or family or friends or whatever gifts God gives us, that ability to enjoy those things comes only from God. So in these last verses here in chapter 5, Solomon once again calls us back to the joy that we can find only in God, and they call upon us to be grateful for the gifts that God gives us. Let me illustrate it like this. There was a poem written by George Herbert, the poem called The Pulley. And in this poem, he begins by saying that when God first made man, he took his glass and he poured out all the blessings that he could, riches and beauty and wisdom and honor. But when the glass was almost empty, God decided to stop pouring. And then this is what Herbert wrote in his poem. When almost all was out, God made a stay, perceiving that alone of all his treasure, rest in the bottom lay. In other words, as God was pouring out all these gifts, the one gift that God decided not to pour out that was in the bottom of the glass was rest. Or perhaps we could say satisfaction. God decided that when he was pouring out all those gifts, that satisfaction that was at the bottom of the glass, he didn't pour that one in into man. And why? He goes on to say in his poem, "For if I should," said he, "bestow this jewel also on my creature, he would adore my gifts instead of me." That's the reason. Because if God would have given us satisfaction in these gifts, then we would learn to enjoy the gifts and not God. So, in his wisdom and love, God decreed that we should be rich and weary. And that very weariness should turn our hearts back to God. So my question tonight to you is, have you turned away from the weariness of wealth to find your joy in God alone? God alone. Our joy needs to come from God alone. He's teaching us to depend upon God for all of our enjoyment. And what gifts does God give? In verse 18, we already saw the gift of enjoyment, the ability to enjoy. But then the gift of fulfillment in verse 19. "Every man also to whom God has given riches and wealth and has given him power to eat thereof and to take his portion and to rejoice in his labor." This is the gift of God. The ability to find fulfillment in the very work that you do. Some people use their work as an idol. But when you focus on God and find your enjoyment in him, he will give you the gift of fulfillment in your labor. And also, contentment in your heart in verse number 20. "For he shall not much remember the days of his life, because God answereth him in the joy of his heart." Solomon is saying the person who learns this principle well will not much remember the days of his life, or we could say the days of vanity, or the days of travail, or the days of meaninglessness. We'll have some difficult days in life. But Solomon is saying, look, if you learn this principle, if you learn to find your joy in God, you're not going to remember those days. You know why? Because God will occupy your heart with joy. He will give you such contentment and such joy in knowing him that all of the bad days will be swallowed up in the joy that God gives you as a result of knowing him. Do you understand what I'm saying? That's the way to live. That's the way to live. Only then can we truly be grateful to God. And so you have to choose which way are you going to approach life. The greedy approach, where a person pursues gold and what he discovers that wealth is the cause of much corruption. It doesn't really satisfy. Others won't want to take it from you. It'll keep you up all night. It's lost very easily and you can't take it when you die. Or you can have a God-centered approach where a person pursues God and what he discovers that when he finds his joy in God, God blesses him by giving him enjoyment in life, fulfillment in his work, and contentment in his heart. So which way do you want to approach life? Now, I think that this is good timing because we're close to what? Thanksgiving, right? And so I think that this should cause us to remember that around this time, and of course it should be every day of our life, but especially around this time, we should give praise and worship and thanksgiving to the giver, not just for the gifts. Now, I remember when I was pastoring another church, we would have a Thanksgiving service, and I would ask for testimonies, and I always was a little bit frustrated with some of the testimonies I heard, I got to be honest, because they seemed to me to be so superficial. Because people say, "I'm thankful for my car, I'm thankful for my house, I'm thankful for this, thankful for that." You know, they would mention all the gifts, but very few people got up and poured out a heart of thanksgiving and worship and praise to the giver of all of these gifts. That's what our focus should be upon. Let us worship and adore and be thankful for the giver of every good and perfect gift. Let's bow for prayer together. And so, Lord, help us all. I can't help but be convicted over these things that I study. Because, Lord, I see some of that greed in my own heart. I see some of that desire for more in my own heart. And it's so easy to replace the pursuing the giver and replace it with pursuing the gifts. And Lord, that's happened to me before, time and time again. So God, forgive me and cleanse me and help me, Lord, every day to find all of my joy, all of my fulfillment, all of my satisfaction in knowing you and walking with you in my relationship to you. Guard me, Lord, from straying from that. And then, Lord, I know that in return, you'll give me real enjoyment. Father, I pray this for my own heart. And I pray this, Lord, for every person here tonight. Let us be a congregation of people that just enjoy you, enjoy who you are. Yes, Lord, you have blessed us with so many things, so many blessings. But may we keep our focus upon you. How many of us say tonight, that's my prayer as well, that my focus will be on the giver always, that I'll find all my joy in him. Would you lift your hand tonight? That's my heart desire. Now, Father, seal these words to our heart. And as we approach this Thanksgiving season, let it be a time when our hearts overflow with gratitude and love and true thankfulness to you, the great giver of all that we have and all that we are. And we pray in Jesus' name, amen.